The new Secretary of State, did Mitch Daniels make a good choice? The court ruling that made it possible, Dick Lugar loses a residency ruling, plus the final word on the 2012 legislature. That, plus our General Assembly awards and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 16,
2012. Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, Mitch Daniels chose a new Secretary of State. State Senator Connie Lawson will fill out the remainder of Charlie White's term.
Sure, I considered other names, but Connie's was the first name I thought of, and there was never really a rival. I just look at her credentials for this job, look at her reputation for legislative integrity.
This new opportunity to serve all Hoosiers, Republicans and Democrats, across the state is a responsibility that I take very seriously.
Is that a good choice? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Eric Holcomb, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shelley. Ann Delaney, is that a good choice?
Well, I think Senator Lawson has been an excellent senator, okay, and I think she'd make a good Secretary of State. But in terms of choosing it, you know, Secretary of State really isn't a very important office, okay?
It's the number three office in state government.
It's not an important office.
It's the state's chief elections officer.
We've seen how important that is. What it does do, it seems to me, is allow you to groom the next generation. And that's the way it's been used successfully in the past, to take somebody in their 30s and start grooming them for potential important statewide office. And I don't think Senator Lawson comes under that category. So the only real explanation besides the fact of her qualifications is that Mitch Daniels is going to appoint a man on the Supreme Court now. And so we will continue to be one of only four states in the union without a woman Supreme Court justice.
Well, we're going to learn that in the near future. Interesting take, however. I asked Connie Lawson, she could run for election in 2014. I asked her if she planned to do that. She said that she's going to position herself for that, but she didn't commit. This is more about bringing stability to the office than grooming somebody for the future, is it not?
Well, sure. It doesn't surprise me that Senator Lawson would answer the question that way. She is extremely focused, understands the task at hand, and will assume a lot quickly, coming up on a very important election year that she'll have to administer. So. I think if it were a Democrat governor and he had to or she had to pick a Secretary of State of the opposite party, they might have settled on Senator Connie Lawson as well. I haven't heard a person say a bad thing or that she's not up for this job. She is extremely qualified.
She has an interesting resume. She's been a county clerk, run elections in Hendricks County. She's been chair of the elections committee in the state Senate. She's been in leadership in the state Senate. But I think the biggest qualification probably is that she's the kind of person who's not going to make waves.
I think you're right,
Jim. There have been too many.
You're right. The resume, of course, you can check off all of the boxes in terms of her experiences and her expertise, and it certainly does lend itself to being the state's chief election officer. But you're right. This, after 16 months of pitched battle, of controversy.
17, I think.
17, who's counting? I mean, it's been a long time.
Right.
And I think, the governor, numerous people on both sides, I mean, Eric, I think, had basically before the election called for Charlie White to step aside, as many Republican leaders had. So this has been, 15, 16, 17 months of banging one's head against the wall. Now the pain can subside finally, and you want to do something that, to your point, Jim, is going to be acceptable to people on both sides of the aisle. This is a known commodity. Connie Lawson has friends on both sides of the aisle, and she's competent. So now everybody can take a deep breath and kind of move on to something else.
Is this the last chapter in the Charlie White saga?
No, it's not. We've still got an appeal that's hanging out there. We don't know what happens if, for instance, the Court of Appeals overturns his convictions. Not likely to happen, but what happens then? So, unfortunately,
I think he's restored to office.
Unfortunately, that saga still is going on. But I just have to say two things. First of all, good on Jerry Bonnet, the former chief deputy who has been running the office since Charlie White was forced to leave, and Connie Lawson's appointment. He's been terrific. He's been a good job. Done a good job here. Secondly, I think Connie Lawson's a great choice. I think that you need to bring some semblance to the office. It is an important office because it does have a very important function in elections, and we have to restore confidence in elections because it's been rocked by this episode.
All right, the state Supreme Court ruling that cleared the way for the governor's choice was unanimous. The court found that ousted Secretary of State Charlie White was legally registered when he was elected in November of 2010. A jury found White guilty of felonies for lying about his registration in the May 2010 primary. He was removed from office in February. The ruling was a defeat for the state Democratic Party.
We respect the Supreme Court's decision. Don't agree with it, but we respect it.
And that state Democratic Chairman Dan Parker, Eric Holcomb as state Republican chairman. What's it mean to have this case behind you?
It's good to have the sideshow behind us and start looking forward. But, you know, we predicted this at the outset. I think I was on this show when we said that we were confident that the Supreme Court would rule this way, and they did, 5-0, unanimous. No voter was disenfranchised, and we're pleased with it.
The Democrats had won a lower court ruling. It was reversed. Essentially, what the high court did was say that the state recount commission did the right thing.
Essentially, I think what the highest court said was that if you're on the ballot and you get more votes, it doesn't matter how you got on the ballot, okay? You're going to be elected. And that's an interesting...
They're very reluctant to overturn the will of the voters.
I don't think very reluctant. I think they won't overturn. Right. And no matter what you had to do to get on that ballot. And, you know, that's certainly an interesting position to take.
Yeah. Any lessons to be drawn from this that we haven't already?
Timing is everything. I think if the appeal had been made before the election occurred, we might have had a different outcome. And, you know, if somebody had challenged his candidacy beforehand, then, you know, this whole saga may not have occurred. So timing is everything is what we learned from this.
And we talked about that a few weeks ago as we were making predictions, talked about the importance of timing. And if again, we weren't saying that the court was looking for a technicality on which it could rule as opposed to the bigger issues, the more substantive issues, but this was as close to ruling on a technicality as you can by saying, you know, hey, you missed your window of opportunity. It slammed shut, and you missed it. But what I think is good about the ruling, whether you're on one side or the other, unanimous. You got to like unanimous rulings, yes, especially when you have a court of the five members.
Brent Dixon did have a dissenting opinion, but he came to the same conclusion.
Same conclusion. But you have three of the justices were appointed by Republican governors, two by Democratic governors. And when you have an issue like this that's so politically charged, there's some comfort, again, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on, there's some comfort when you have unanimity. I mean, that's Brown versus Board of Education, if you want to when the U.S. Supreme Court, when the Indiana Supreme Court can rule unanimously, it gives comfort that there's maybe some way to rise above politics.
No partisan motives.
Right.
All right. Now to a case that deals with residency where maybe there were some partisan motives. The Marion County Election Board ruled this week that Senator Richard Lugar and his wife are ineligible to vote in Indiana, at least for now. For more than 35 years, the senator has listed a near West Side home as his voting address, but he sold the home in 1977 and moved to Virginia. On a 2-to-1 vote along party lines, the board determined Senator Lugar abandoned his residence 34 years ago and violated election law by returning to his former precinct to vote. The lone Republican on the board protested the vote.
And in this case, I think this board utterly failed to consider the circumstances of the alleged violation of election law.
P.J. Dietrich there. John Ketzenberger, what's the net effect of this ruling?
The issue remains alive. It remains a viable issue, and gosh, the Democrats might be happy about that because it seems to be one of those things that allows the Murdoch campaign to avoid all the issues and just keep trying to hammer home this point. Whether it's successful or not, I think it's rather weak, but They get the issue still. It's still alive.
Has no effect on Senator Lugar's ballot status. He can still run. The question is, can he vote for himself? He can create residency in another way. He could rent an apartment. He could maybe, as I understand it, just cite the clerk's office as his voting address.
I think he could do any number of things, and there's precedent for doing any number of things. He also has ownership, joint ownership of rural farm agricultural property in central Indiana that conceivably he could use. The tough spot for him is if you switch it, then it's a de facto acknowledgement, perhaps, or at least his critics would say it's a de facto acknowledgement that what he was doing in the past was wrong.
Right.
So I think his only recourse is the one that we'll see, which is that this will be appealed.
He's going to court.
And it'll go to court because, again, I think politically, legally there's no problem for him, as we've all agreed many times before, and as every attorney general and any number of panels that have looked at this, but politically it's problematic.
Should he have done something differently?
This is
to avoid this.
Politically transparent as they come. This was an attempt by the Democratic Party to stoke this issue. They had their decision before they walked into the room, the election division, the 2-1 decision.
They had a staff recommendation.
Sure. They knew what they were going to do, and they got what they wanted. But this is yet another. It's not a judge, but it's a commission. All these lawsuits, school voucher bill and right to work and overturn an election, these ultimately always fizzle out at the end, but we unfortunately have to divert taxpayers' attention.
I'm just curious, though, if it's a Democratic conspiracy, why did you have the person who brought the complaint and his attorney were both Republicans?
Republicans.
Sure. Well, this commission.
Well, they are.
Well, they're Tea Party.
They're clearly opponents of Senator Lugar.
Well, I know, but the point is they are Republicans.
Even though they won't,
the county
necessarily own up to that.
Far from being nonpartisan. Yeah. Right. This is the same person that decided that UAW would pay for satellite voting stations.
And
right?
this, if you bother to read the opinion, was a very well-reasoned opinion, and it was based on fact. Okay, the residency issue in terms of candidacy is established by the constitutions and was done by the state election board in a bipartisan fashion. This is not a question of residency. This is a question of where he resides. And the problem with Senator Lugar is you have to show an intent to return. He has not had any association with that particular residence since he sold it 35 years ago.
But you can't prove whether he has an intent to return unless or until he leaves office.
Wait a second.
Right?
It shows it's a rebuttable presumption. He presented no evidence. If he had maintained a right to buy that property back, if he had done anything to show that he was going to maintain a residence in Indiana, he might have had a different outcome of that. He did none of that.
All right, but nevertheless, this is about a political issue about proving that
it's
he's out of touch.
There's a different standard for being a resident for purposes of candidacy and being a voter.
Back to the previous discussion, it's a technicality. They found a technicality, right?
Following the election law is now a technicality. Well, under that argument, Charlie White shouldn't have been charged.
One that's inconsistent with three attorney generals' decisions, one that's inconsistent with
the
same election commission provided prior.
The attorney general has no business giving an opinion to a U.S. senator
about his
candidacy.
Precisely why they didn't take it to this one. They avoided taking it to this one for that reason, to keep it within that body.
And so when you're saying the attorney general opinions, the ones you're citing who had no business giving the opinion are all Republicans. So don't tell me about being bipartisan.
Well, but he also had, in 1977, a voter registration board ruling that was bipartisan. That was bipartisan.
Yeah. In 1977, the argument was a little bit weaker than it is 35 years later.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in connection with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, who benefits most from the Lugar residency challenge? Your choices are A, Richard Murdoch, B, Joe Donnelly, or C, the legal profession. Last week's question was, which of the following describes Dick Lugar's negative ads? 13% said hypocritical, 77% said necessary, 10% said outrageous. To take part in the poll, just go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. An Indianapolis school bus crash killed a bus driver and a 5-year-old student this week, and renewed debate over the need for seatbelts on school buses. But the folks at IMMI in Westfield say a new law might not be necessary. A spokesman for the seat manufacturer says all of the seats they are now building come with lap belts and shoulder restraints. They believe buses without restraints will soon be a thing of the past.
It's a safety generation. Children are used to climbing in vehicles.
putting the lap and shoulder belt on, and sometimes they wonder where they had.
James Johnson there. John Schwanis, is a seatbelt law necessary?
I'll tell you, this is it's a tragedy. There's nothing good comes out of this. But I'll tell you, about every so often these tragedies occur, and they inevitably trigger this debate. And it's come up before, and there have been quite strong feelings on both sides. You have schools who have said, you know, we don't want, some schools put three kids in a seat as opposed to two. Some schools say it's prohibitively expensive. And in fact, the Department of Education in the state says, I think the $160 million is the price tag it would put on retrofitting current buses.
Existing buses.
And when you think, you want to put that in perspective, we just had, trumpeted the fact that the General Assembly earmarked $80 million for full-day kindergarten, which is a big deal in K-12
right.
education. We're talking about twice that amount of money. And again, I feel awkward talking about money because you can't put money on lives. But it is as a practical matter, it's prohibitively expensive. The states that do have seatbelt requirements.
Six states have seatbelt requirements.
But only for buses that are built and put into service.
None of them require retrofitting.
It's a tough call. It's a tough situation.
Does this problem solve itself?
This problem comes up whenever there's a tragedy, and it's understandable for this. But when you look at the overall safety record of school bus transportation, it's incredibly safe, and it's also cost-effective from a school's perspective. We've seen in Franklin Township how important that is to people who are parents. Everybody wants their kids to make it home from school and to school safely every day, and the record shows that these tragedies are the aberration, and that every day millions of kids get back and forth to school every day. I think it's a cost factor, but I think that it's not an outrageous safety factor right now. Right now it's the aberration. Until it becomes a problem all the time, I think that the current regulations are sufficient.
Well, James Johnson made an interesting point that kids are used to strapping in now, where that didn't used to be the case not too long ago. And there are retractable seat belts where there were problems in the past with seat belts that kids used to strike each other.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the only way this is going to get fixed is going forward, because the local schools and all local units of government are so strapped for cash under this property tax freeze.
Right.
We're going to be laying off cops and teachers and everything else. There isn't $160 million, no matter how much it might make safety more important for kids.
Do you think this comes up in the legislature next year?
It very well might, and probably should. We need to do anything and everything we can to prevent a future horrible scenario like this from playing out again.
It's been more than a month since the Right to Work bill was signed into law, but it was the biggest issue in the 2012 General Assembly, and it continues to dominate the political discussion in this state. State lawmakers completed their work for 2012 early on Saturday morning by passing an automatic tax refund that will be worth $50 to most Indiana taxpayers. This session will always be remembered, however, for the struggle over the Right to Work bill. Governor Mitch Daniels said this week that he underestimated what it would mean.
Right to Work was a very important achievement. We've already signed new agreements with three companies, one announced and two to come soon. There are 31 companies as of Friday night now on our negotiation rolls who have identified Right to Work as a major, if not the major, factor in their interest in Indiana.
Least attractive state in the nation is Mississippi, Right to Work. Highest unemployment state, Nevada, Right to Work state. So there's not much to look forward there.
All right, that was Monday when the governor made that comment about.
And now Friday
forward,
he has to eat crow.
Well, he's not eating crow. The company that he cited that he said expanded here because of Right to Work, the owner said that wasn't the motivating factor.
Right.
But he apparently did sign off on a quote that was used.
Which he didn't obviously read before he signed off on it. They probably called him and said, I hope it's poor staffing, because I don't believe the governor would deliberately mislead people about this. But clearly the one example that he cited doesn't exist.
Well, the governor said he backtracked on this and says that the fellow supports Right to Work, even though he says that wasn't the reason. It is a little messy, isn't it?
Well, yeah. For whatever reason this company chose to grow their business in Indiana is good. Right to Work is a tool in the toolbox, and we'll continue to build the state.
Okay. Good soft shoe routine, Eric.
Has Right to Work been oversold?
Yes.
No. The governor never claimed this was going to be a silver bullet. He said this would be yet another tool in the toolbox, and that's what it's proven to be.
What
these companies don't want is all this hostility that you just showed showing up on their parking lot every day. That's why folks are reluctant. They don't
actually. That's what the governor suggested today. Is that the owner of this company in Brookville said he thinks right to work is a good deal, but when the governor started saying that he thought it was a good deal, he's worried about the union showing up. Is that
the folks that are growing their businesses here don't want that distraction. They want to grow their businesses.
Right. If you're in the Daniels administration, this is not what you want. You want to be able to come out of the gates from a controversial issue and do what the governor initially had done, which is say, I've had 30 companies reach out because of this. We have three who signed on the dotted line. Here's one that's done it. You want the first one to be the poster child, not the embarrassment. And that's what this has become. It's stirred controversy. And it makes me think, remember the good old days when a direct quote, when quotation marks actually suggested that somebody said that?
Instead of a staffer
instead of somebody in the state administration writing it and getting a sign off. It kind of stinks. It really does.
I think that the whole situation is really very difficult because it's unverifiable. What the governor says is unverifiable. The real bottom line, there are two. You look at the state's revenue, specifically in personal income tax returns, because that means more people are working. It's been flat lately, but it had been going up. And secondly, you look at median income, and it's been going down. So until those two things change, this is all noise.
Well, it's all noise, and it's all sell, is what it is. It's sell, because they don't have any evidence of it, except that it'll drive wages
down. It's noise
on
both sides.
To what degree will this be a campaign issue?
Oh, it'll be a huge campaign issue. It'll be a huge campaign issue. Not just because he broke his word to people, okay? That's part of it. But the other part of it is he can't sell it. And people who are working in these jobs know that it's designed to drive wages down.
You think that Republicans will be defeated and Democrats will win because of right to work?
Because of that and because of the war on women. I think, frankly, the Republican Party is in the control of the Tea Party people. And when you see what happened in Arizona this week, where they're not even allowed to have birth control. You're not even allowed to have birth control unless you can show it's for something other than family planning. They're crazy.
Is Rush Limbaugh hurting you?
No. That's another Republican who won't stand up to them.
We're doing just fine here as a Republican Party. We have all the statewide elected offices. We have 60 state reps. We have a quorum proof in the state Senate. If that's a problem, I'll take it every day.
You worry about defending right to work?
You think we'll lose the majority in either chamber?
I don't think you're going to lose the majority. I think you're going to lose seats.
Do you worry about defending right to work in November?
No.
Not at all.
You know, as interesting as this is at the state level, where it's really going to be interesting now is this is a national issue. It was before, and it will be again. Mm-hmm. Already, Ohio, Rhode Island, you have any number of states this week that are pointing to Indiana and say, we want to be number 24, we want to be number 25. And what you're going to have, the argument was Indiana wanted to do this, according to Mitch Daniels, to have a competitive advantage. It's going to be like casinos. Pretty soon everybody's going to have right to work, and if you don't have right to work, then the argument's going to become, we've got to do it just to keep pace with the rest of the country.
And then when we take control of the Congress, they can change the federal law, and right to work will be out the door.
All right, finally, it's time now for the remainder of our Indiana Week in Review General Assembly Awards. We begin with the departing lawmaker who will be missed most, Eric Holcomb.
I would say he hasn't lost yet, but Craig Battles. Elvis will not leave the building.
You're saying Bruce Borders will beat Craig Battles
come
in
November.
Okay. Departing lawmaker who will be missed.
I think there are two. From an emotional standpoint, John Day, and from an ability to work across the aisle, Dale Grubbs.
I think Dale Grubb is an excellent example. I love John Day. I love the fact that he had that consistency over time. But I think Jeff Espick and Bill Crawford's departures will be very big for the legislature.
As usual, I get to the scraps. I'm going to say both people on the fiscal policy front, Espick and Crawford, for the reasons John mentioned. And John Day, nobody has been a more passionate champion of the underdog and the underprivileged and disadvantaged over recent decades. So he'll be missed as well.
I'm going to go with Espick and Crawford. Lawmaker least deserving of re-election, Ann.
Brian Bosma, for allowing the most divisive session in history. And in addition, when his mayor wanted mass transit, his Republican mayor, and he's the speaker, and he sees to it that it's killed.
Pat Bauer, no one in the legislature had more responsibility and got the least for it.
So Bosma didn't have
least
as much
deserving
responsibility as Bauer.
Yeah, if you want to look at who brought the context of most embarrassing headlines for the state of Indiana, probably Bob Morris for the Girl Scout controversy.
I'll second that.
I think Bob Morris is a pretty good choice. All right. The most improved lawmaker, Eric Holcomb.
That's kind of a backhanded compliment, isn't it? the freshman class. They came in as rookies and ended this year as veterans.
Morris among them.
Another successful session.
The most improved, I'm going to kind of change things a little bit. I'm going to say Sturwald, because I think that he was able to keep some of that freshman class from some of the more crazy ideas they had.
I think that Ed Delaney's going to have to improve even more if they're going to have a future on the Democrat side in the House.
Brian Bosma, I mean, he wasn't bad before, but he's had a tough challenge dealing with the freshman and dealing with some of the issues.
Linda Lawson, before we go, quickly, nothing but the name, Lawmaker of the Year.
Jerry Torr.
Right to Work author. He's,
Ed Delaney, clearly.
Quick.
Luke Kenley.
Brian Bosma.
I think, let's go with Jerry Torr. That's the biggest issue. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Eric Holcomb, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcaster starting Monday. You can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in 1,000 different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.